Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have like a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Chase Thomas podcast. The Chase Thomas podcast. My nephew needs me to record. See, I already hate it.
All right, we're back. It's Friday, so you know what that means. It is the three Atlanta natives, Garrett Chapman and Max Markovich, and myself, Chase Thomas, here on a gloomy Friday afternoon, not only in Knoxville, Tennessee, but also down there in Atlanta, Georgia. Garrett, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
I'm good, Chase. How are you, man?
I'm good. Max, what about yourself?
Doing well. Wish the weather would clear up, but other than that, nothing wrong.
It was 65 the other day, and my run was perfect. I think it was like Tuesday, I want to say. I don't know if it was like that where you guys. And then just immediately the next day, down to 25 degrees, and I was very upset. I'm ready for winter to be over. I'm ready to move on from winter time. But it looks like we're still going to have it for a little bit. I've decided on our name. I don't know if you guys knew this or not, but I've decided on a name.
Okay. Interesting.
Okay. This is something that I spent a lot of time. I did the digging. I consulted with all the top marketing agencies. I watched a lot of Mad Men leading up to this decision. And what I came to the conclusion of was, why are we overthinking this? Let's just do Atlanta Sports Guys. That's what we're doing. That's what I've decided. Atlanta Sports Guys. It's the easiest one.
I love it.
It's like straight to the point.
Kiss. Keep it simple, stupid.
Exactly.
I love it.
All right. There we go. We're all on board. We got it. Easy merch. Like, we'll eventually have some merch to move, and we can do all that kind of stuff. So that's what we're going to go with, and that's what I as long as you guys are good with that. Lot of Atlanta stuff that we've got to talk about. We need to start with the Hawks because you guys have been chomping at the bit to just tear down the point guard in Atlanta, getting fined, just making a fool of himself in the end of the Mavericks-Hawks game, just getting really angry, pissing off John Collins on the court to make him look elsewhere for his new team. How do you guys feel about Trae Young and why both of you, Max and Garrett, are just so out on Atlanta's young superstar point guard?
Wow. Well, that lead in was compelling. I think there's only one of the three of us who might be out on Trae Young, and I don't think it's Garrett nor I.
Well, I have to push back. Like, it's going to hurt my feelings the way you two talk about Cam Reddish today, and we'll get to that in a bit, but, in all seriousness, John Collins doesn't look like he's long for the Atlanta Hawks. We've seen, we just thought this was coming when they traded for Clint Capela, that like that was the failsafe, because ultimately I don't necessarily agree with Max, who in the text thread was telling us that he is a fan, so I'm going to get to this in a second, of the Capela Collins pairing. I thought the writing was on the wall there, and then the Athletic story from friend of the pod Chris Kirshner outlining they're cool on the court, but or off the court, but they're not necessarily enjoying each other's company on the court. I think this sentiment's probably the case for every player not named Trae Young on the Hawks, just my guess. But Max, make the case for the Hawks not trading John Collins, paying him, and Clint Capela in today's NBA. Make the case.
Yeah. You definitely put me in a hole there, but I'm going to try to get out. I would not say I'm a fan of, per se, of the Clint Capela-John Collins pairing. I don't think anyone would say that that is the ideal pairing for John Collins to play with. But I am a fan of John Collins, and I'm just going to rattle off a few stats to illustrate that I think he's really having an underrated year, and honestly quietly built together an underrated first few years in the NBA. He's, first of all, he's 23. He's got better every single year he's been in the NBA. He's 40% from three now for the second year in a row, which sort of proves that that's not a fluke. That's real. He's 19th in true shooting, 17th in offensive win shares, 24th in total win shares, 13th in Raptor, which I don't know what that means, but it's definitely something. And his on-off splits this year are ridiculous. I mean, they're I don't have the numbers in front of me, but he's like above the 90th percentile in on-off differential in the NBA. All of which is to say he's a really – oh, and one thing I want to point out is I think that there's like this complete misconception based on early in his career that he's like a total sieve defensively. I think he's been average at worst this year, and honestly slightly above average defensively. And all the tools are there for him to be an above average defender for the rest of his career. And all of that is to say that if you have a guy like that, I don't know why you're so eager to move on from him. And I know the case that the fit doesn't really work, but particularly in the NBA where asset retention is just kind of everything, and the Hawks aren't going to recoup the value that he brings right now in a trade, if there was one, I would just pay him. I would keep him, and I'd be happy with that because he's one of the better up-and-coming players in the league.
Garrett, what do you think?
So trading John Collins also runs you into a whole bunch of issues because, I mean, he has that rookie deal. He's in place right now. So that makes it very tricky. I mean, I don't want to get all too deep into the weeds as far as like salary cap restrictions and how you have to match offers or whatever. But trading a rookie contract is already very complicated. But I think the Atlanta Hawks do see him on this roster. They wanted him on this roster. I mean, just this past offseason, there were a few reports that came out saying that they offered him a multi-year deal worth $90 million. So I think the real question was, do they see him as a max guy or not, which I guess they didn't. But they still have the restricted free agency. I still think he's I've kind of grown cold on the idea of trading John Collins because, like Max said, I mean, the guy is very good. He plays good basketball, and I think the Hawks are at their best when he's on the court. And I mean, I don't think that the Atlanta Hawks can compete in the playoffs, or for the playoffs, rather, if he's not on this roster, because he needs to be here. He's a focal point of this team, especially with all these injuries that we've had in other places on the roster. So I think he's still going to be on this team. I've cooled on the idea of him getting traded. I don't think he will. And I think the report specifically said it was like they're listening to offers. So I think that all they're saying is like, hey, if you have a great offer, send it my way. So I don't think they're actively shopping him per se, because I think there are a lot of contenders who look at John Collins and say, that guy can help me win a championship this year. So they're opening the door saying, hey, the door's unlocked. The door's unlocked, but I'm not going to open it for you. So I wouldn't be surprised if he got traded. I just don't think he will at this point.
Interesting. I mean, I think he's going to get traded. I think this is something where it's going to get continually worse. Because what is his usage rate right now? And if you had to guess, and like, let me see where he's at right now. Because I want to.
He's taking like I think he's taking like two fewer shots a game this year than last year.
And if the Hawks continue to struggle, if they continue to flirt with 500 basketball, or they go on a skid, they go on a 4-5 game skid, Collins, him asking out or him putting pressure on the organization to be like, get me out of here where I can play and be the max player that I think I am, I could see that. I could see Collins forcing the Hawks' hand.
I don't think so.
Yeah,
because he still has until the end of the season. I mean, he still has. This is still his contract year. So I mean, I don't see him trying to push his way out per se, because he has the rest of his career after this offseason. Now, of course, the Atlanta Hawks have the option of signing to match whatever some other team signs him for, just because he's a restricted free agent. But I don't see him pushing his way out. I don't know why he would do that. All he has to do is be patient, wait it out for a few months, and I don't see him actually requesting a trade formally and coming out public with it, unless things are much worse than we expect than we think they are.
Max,
I don't think a trade would be initiated from the Hawks end right now, because I don't think you can say, hey, this is the year we make a playoff push. Like, we have to make the playoffs, which is their stated goal, and have that be compatible with trading your second best player in the middle of the year. Even if you are, you know, because honestly, like, how are you even on the outside looking in at any point this year because of the play-in tournament? I mean, you even if they went on a skid here, they're in it. They're in that hunt, and if that's their goal, they can't initiate a trade. So things would really have to become really bad in the locker room, on the court with Collins, and he'd really have to sort of force his way out for me to see that trade happening. But then you get to the same point you were at last offseason, which is, do you want to max him or not? And I think it's pretty obvious the organization doesn't want to do that.
Nor should they. He's not a max player. Like, is there any case for John Collins max player?
We can discuss that. I can see the argument. And
okay, make the case.
I would say that, because there's a difference between like capital M max guys and like lowercase M max guys. And is John Collins like a capital M, like superstar guy you build a team around as the first player? No. But if the option is matching a max offer or losing him for nothing, that's a different conversation than does he, you know, is this his deserving pay? Because you also don't exactly get the cap space back, given what he makes now. It's not, you just lose him for nothing.
Yeah, but I think it's also just when you forecast, okay, so he was already upset about the contract failures from this past offseason, right? Like, he probably wishes that he got the extension and that he didn't have to go into this year on the 1 year, like the last year of his rookie deal, and then go into an uncertain offseason. My guess is, if you don't do anything and you let this play out, and then you go into the summer and just let John go and see what the best offer is, and then he comes back with like a max offer from like the Magic or something, and then they match it, and he's like, you told me to get the best offer, and now y'all are gonna match it, and now I'm because it's not gonna be the money that he ultimately wants. It might end up being less than what the Hawks offered him reportedly before the season. So then you're at like just this nuclear situation of just really pissing this guy off, because we know how this goes with restricted free agency and like how annoyed teams get, or players get at their teams for how they just view them in restricted free agency. So most of the teams now, if they really value you long term, they are getting an extension done before you get to this point. And if they don't really value you long term, then they don't do this. So it's clear that they don't value him the way they value Trey, or they value some of the other young guys on this roster, and probably will. That is something that John Collins obviously knows. And if they were to let him go out and get the best offer, it's kind of like when Gordon Hayward was pissed off that the Hornets gave him the good offer sheet and he went back to Utah, that Utah just let him go see what was out there for him, let him go test the market. Most players don't want to go test the market as restricted free agents. Like, it's kind of like a slap in the face, and I don't see that ultimately going well. And then, you know, I don't know what his trade value is going to look like by next summer. Like, is his trade value going to go up or down if he keeps playing the way he is this season? Like, I don't know. I think this is a very complicated situation. You think so?
Yes. I mean, if he keeps playing the way he is, I mean, the guy has developed an outside shot that rivals that of like a shooting guard. The guy looks fantastic, and he's a power forward center. I mean, he's a young, bouncy player. Like Max said, his defense is a lot better. But there's also one thing that you hinted at in what you were just saying, and that's Trae Young. And one thing that the Atlanta Hawks need to do is they need to turn the page and turn into a team that competes for the playoffs, because Trae Young is going to be a max with a capital M coming up.
Yep.
He's not going to re-sign with the Atlanta Hawks if we're just going to be a team like the Suns, who continuously pick these good players, and there's tons of them, but then we just turn them over, and then they all move on, or maybe they don't work out, or whatever. And
shout out
Booker
Dragon
signed
Bender.
That big deal. Yeah, no, and Booker signed that big old deal, and they're still really kind of a middling team. They're finally starting to turn the page a little bit this year, but I mean, he's going to want to play on a contender. He's going to want to win championships. That's the guy that Trae Young is, or at least that's what he says he is on Twitter. And by all intents and purposes, that's what I see in him. But why would he want to come back to Atlanta if we're just going to continuously be this middle of the road team who like maybe can make a push for the playoffs this year? Oh, and actually, now that we're in playoff contention, we're going to ship off our second best player. So, what are your goals exactly? Are you trying to make the playoffs, or are you just trying to? Are you still looking for the next 2, 3, 4 years? I don't know if Trae wants to be a part of that. So, and that's something that they have to keep in their, at least in the back of their mind, because that contract's coming up pretty quickly.
Yeah, and they're going to get it done as soon as they possibly can. Whenever they are able to agree to the max or Trae, they are doing that.
They'll throw a max at him as soon as possible, because he is the focal point of this team. He is this basketball team.
Yeah, which, as I've made a point about, not great. Not what I would have done. Not the strategy I would have done. Max, any last thoughts on John Collins and what happened to
him? Yeah, I think you both brought up really good points there. The Trae stuff, like, that's going to become a real thing really soon, particularly if they don't make the playoffs this offseason. But Chase, the point you brought up about how the Hawks have handled this, which I completely agree with. I think there's a discrepancy here between what the Hawks think and how the Hawks feel and how I feel and what I would do. And it's clear the Hawks do not value John Collins, maybe the way that I'm expressing right now. And so the stuff they've done in the past, like how they handled last offseason, is almost a different conversation to me. It's like you have sort of three options right now, and they are let things play out to the offseason, trade him, or, you know, match any offer that comes in this offseason, right? And so I'm saying of all those options, I'm maybe willing to overpay like 5%, 10% above what I think he is. But I'm not saying that that's what the Hawks are willing to do right now.
No. And I think we'll learn a lot more in the next few weeks. This is going to be a very important time for the John Collins future experience in Atlanta and where he goes. What were your big takeaways from the Mavs game this week, guys?
Frustration, pounding my head against the wall. It was the most frustrating thing, and it's the same damn thing that's been happening all season. And it's when Trae comes off the floor, which he did in the third quarter, you see a dramatic drop off, because Dunn came out on the floor because Rondo's hurt. Everyone's hurt, and then Trae came off the floor, and Cam Reddish was on there, which we're going to get into Cam Reddish in a little bit, and he wasn't able to get it done. He wasn't able to be the point guy. As far as the chief scoring option, the Mavs just storm on back. They rush Trae back on the floor. They take a lead again, and then they just fall apart because Trae plays 40 minutes a game and he's throwing up shots and it just, oh my God. And it's just so frustrated. I'm still a little upset if you can't tell.
Yeah. It's just going to be a frustrating season. I think I've just resigned myself to the Hawks just frustrating me all season long. I think this is who they're going to be. They're going to be nights where they're everything clicking and it makes sense, and there are going to be other nights like this where it's like, it's just not all there. There's just something not right. Let's have the Cam Reddish conversation. Who wants to start this? Because I am going to take my headphones off, go into the other room, light a cigarette, and I'll come back when y'all are done.
I'll kick things off then. It's such a tough conversation because I think coming into this year, we sort of grouped Cam Reddish and DeAndre Hunter together as the two promising signs of really good stuff coming, with two promising wings, trying to maximize their development. Right. But if you take a step back now, and he's been horrible, I mean, he's been horrible all year. And there's really no other way to say that. And if we're talking about takeaways from the Mavs game, like I was saying, I was screaming, you know, I'd much rather see Solomon Hill or Tony Snell at this point. And I don't know if there's any way around that. But if you take a step back at Cam Reddish's career now, if you can't do this, obviously, but if you cut out the last 40 games of last year, He's basically like a high 30s percent field goal shooter for his career, including college. And he's basically a mid to high 23-point shooter. So if we're talking about promise for Cam Reddish, we're talking about 40 games, or sorry, 20 whatever games last year that he was really good. I mean, he shot 46% from the field during that span, 42% from three, showed signs of being a really able defender. And it was like, okay, you know, you got a steal there at 10, and you've hopefully got a long-term starter. He just hasn't been that all year. And at this point, there's no reason to justify. Like, he has no business playing 29 minutes per game on a team that wants him to make the playoffs. Like, it just can't. It can't work like that.
Yeah. Go ahead, Garrett.
Well, it's not. I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, like, he shot 40-plus percent from three-pointer, from deep last year, like the last 25 games. Where's that guy? What happened? I really have absolutely no idea, because this year he's just playing into this ISO ball. And I think I saw something. It was like the Atlanta Hawks are averaging like 0.22 points per possession when Reddish shoots out of an isolation. Like, what the hell is that? What is that? He's shooting 23% from mid-range. I mean, that's so frustrating to watch. And I'm also not a big proponent of ISO ball. I think ISO ball is one of the most frustrating things that I can ever see on the basketball court. And Cam Reddish, I give guys like James Harden or Kevin Durant or those guys, give those guys full credit. Those guys can go ISO because they're just incredible. Cam Reddish is not one of those guys. He's not going to be able to hit these turnaround jump shots that he's been trying to take. And it's just very frustrating to watch. But at the same time, Max, I disagree with you on this. He needs to be on the floor because he has to be out there. He's still in his second year, and you're just going to have to live with it for now. But I think it comes down to coaching. Lloyd Pierce has to put him in better positions. He needs to set him up to take better shots. And if he's taking these bad shots, then pull him out of the game, put him back in a little bit later, and then like hopefully coach him up in practice. Just cut his minutes a little bit. Like make sure he's taking the right shot. I mean, I'm just frustrated with it. I mean, I'm all worked up. I'm losing my train of thought.
As a counter to that. As a counter to that, what is a good shot for Cam Reddish right now? Because I don't think they're catch-and-shoot threes. I definitely don't think they're pick-and-roll, anything out of the pick-and-roll, period. Maybe as a slasher. Like, I don't see what a good shot.
It's the backdoor cuts. It's him eventually. Cutting. It's him just looking for Trey inside and then drawing contact and getting used to using his body like that. Kind of like what Mikal Bridges does in Phoenix. I don't know if y'all saw 10 things from Zach Lowe today on ESPN.com. But one of his 10 things was Mikal Bridges turning into a 3-and-D guy, with the second D being driving. And that's like part of the development of going from good role player to great role player in today's NBA. And like that is something Mikal Bridges has added to his game, is that he's just really good at driving and taking smaller guards with him when they switch. And I think that's what Cam has to do, is when he is playing the two and gets switched on to smaller guards, that he just drives and gets used to drawing contact and getting those runners and in the lane and drawing contact and finishing contact. But like, I'm with Garrett that you have to play this out and you have to let him get the lumps. But also, when you have this playoff mandate, and this is why this team is so frustrating, so when you have this preseason playoff mandate, Lloyd Pierce knows that if he doesn't make the playoffs, he's fired. That, like, when you have this much pressure on this one year for this arbitrary thing of, like, we have to make the playoffs in a year where we're just going to get fucking curb stomped by the Nets or whoever in the first round, like, that makes the biggest difference in the world and the playoff revenue and all that kind of stuff. But, like, ultimately, I want to see DeAndre Hunter, Cam Reddish, Trae Young, John Collins, and Clint Capella play as many minutes together as possible. And this is why I was always kind of wondering about the veteran signings, was that, like, this is going to supersede some of these wings that need to play and develop, and like you're seeing the usage rate for these guys in the wing just not be there. Now DeAndre Hunter's out for a long time and he might not be right for the rest of the season. We'll see how he comes back, but like you can't have this multi timeline type situation going on in Atlanta where you want to win now but you also aren't comfortable with Cam Reddish being able to fail over and over again while he tries and figure stuff out, because ultimately the Hawks' future is tied not only to Trae Young, but really the guy who was also a part of the Luka trade, Cam Reddish. And if you lose on Cam Reddish, you lost the Luka trade. If you win on Cam Reddish, then it's like, well, we have two all-stars and this is a thing. But the only way Cam's going to get better is by getting in there and failing.
Yeah, yes, and I agree with a lot of what you said and disagree with a lot of what you said. I think that the concurrent timelines are weird. And we haven't talked about Danilo Gallinari yet, but he's been pretty bad.
Yep. And shout out to that really air ball last night. That was our Wednesday night. That was great.
Did not want to see him taking the last shot, I can tell you that. But I disagree on I think, and this gets into a Trae Young conversation that maybe we're not ready to have, but I think...
Oh, I'm ready. Sign me up. I'm ready. I'm back up. Okay, I have my cigarette. I'm ready to bang the gavel.
A lot of some of your assumptions about DeAndre Hunter and Cam Reddish sound like that you want the ball to go through them.
Yes.
And I think that that's probably, I think we've seen from wing development that that's the wrong way to go. And I made a comparison between DeAndre Hunter and Jaylen Brown last week. And their age 22, 23 seasons have been like remarkably similar. Their stats are mirror images of each other. You can look it up on Basketball Reference, but the way that both of those guys were built, and I think is the right way to build up a guy like that, is from sort of the foundation out. Right. So if DeAndre Hunter can be, you know, a decent 3-point shooter and guard certain types of players, you can build off of that to now where he started this year and was pretty good at the pick and roll and could attack guys on cuts and was really blossoming into exactly what you want him to be. And I think that's the way you have to build up Cam Reddish, too. It's not by putting the ball in his hands more and just hoping something good happens. It's about finding out what he's pretty good at, starting there, and then building out all the skills you can build from it. And so that's where I think maybe the Trae Young conversation is a little bit off base, is that Trae Young at his best can be perfect for that kind of guy, and I think is perfect for DeAndre Hunter. It just hasn't worked that way with Cam Reddish at all.
Garrett, what do you think?
I like where you're going with that. No, that's very good. I think you articulated that very, very well, because, I mean, the Boston Celtics did an exceptionally good job developing Jaylen Brown. And I think guys like DeAndre Hunter could be that. And I think DeAndre Hunter, like you said, I mean, he has like flourished in the system. Cam Reddish, I think he's trying to do something that doesn't work within the flow of the offense. And that's where I was really going with it, with the Lloyd Pierce frustration that I was having is, I mean, you got to keep him in this flow of the offense. You got to find his role. He needs to find that, because if he doesn't get that role in the offense, he's not going to continue to develop. And then we're just going to be stuck with this guy who, and like you said, we could lose the Luka trade. I mean, I'm kind of over like those comparisons, but at the same time, it's like, it's still an important part of this team. He's an important part of this team, and he needs to continue to develop and stop taking these bad shots. And I put that at Lloyd Pierce's feet.
Yeah, I think that's also part of it, is like the uncomfortable part of this too, is that I don't think Lloyd Pierce has done a great job this year. I have a lot of Lloyd Pierce questions about him going forward. Some Brett Brown vibes going on with Lloyd Pierce, I think, a little bit. And I don't know. I think this was already going to be a complicated year for him, and he's having to juggle a lot, but I don't think he's done the best job, unfortunately. And I hope things turn around there, but I'm more on the fence about Lloyd Pierce's future in Atlanta than I was coming into the year. Is there any last thing that you would like to that you think we should mention about the Hawks right now that we have not touched on yet?
Yeah, I would just like to say, and we can have this discussion another time, I think the Trae Young conversation in general focuses too much on what he is, sort of his deficiencies, and not on the fact that he's like a transcendent offensive player. And the reason that so much else is sort of put up with is because he's a transcendent offensive player, and he really is. And so I just love watching Trae Young play basketball on a nightly basis, and we'll continue to defend him on this podcast.
Garrett, what do you think?
No, I'm all in on Trae. I think he's the future of this basketball team. He's the future of the city as far as Hawks basketball is concerned. And I think, I mean, like Max said, he's transcendent on the offensive side of the basketball, and I think he's only going to get better. I mean, he's only going to get better, because once he settles down, stops turning the ball over, which are just young mistakes. I mean, he's still, 22 years old? I mean,
yeah.
The guy's transcendent already. and I still see so much of a ceiling for this guy. He can get so much better. And I'm excited to see it, like Max said.
All right. Well, there you have it. We'll trade Trey Young for Bradley Beal today. will the Braves, transitioning to the Braves, will the Braves bring back Shane Green and Mark Melancon? What do you think, Max?
Yeah, I don't know if I have a strong sort of opinion on this. I think the answer is probably yes on at least one of them. And I think, you know, I was just digging through Baseball Reference today, and they have sort of projections for the 2021 season, which I thought was interesting. Neither of their projections are all that inspiring. But I also, as I articulated last week on the pod, my philosophy generally on bullpens is just to build with depth and versatility. Young arms, old arms, you know, new guys, guys who have been here. I think bringing back both of them wouldn't be a bad thing. Melancon's been around forever, pitched for a million teams, and, you know, has been pretty good, I would say. And so I'd be happy if they both came back and you just build through depth and figure it out as the season goes along.
Garrett, what do you think?
So I'm looking at this bullpen. I actually just pulled up the who we have on the roster right now. I mean, I'm looking at it. You have high leverage guys who are guys who could play in the high leverage situation. Will Smith, Chris Martin, Tyler Matchick, AJ Minter. Those are guys who have experience doing that. And I think I'd feel comfortable with those guys coming in. You have guys like Luke Jackson, who a lot of people are like, "Oh my God, Luke Jackson!" But he's a fine relief pitcher. He's still on the roster.
Oh, let me stop you right there. No, he's not. I don't want him in my life anymore. Like, the Luke Jackson experience has been some of the worst relieving experience of my adult life.
I don't like him in high leverage. I don't like him in the high leverage. But I'm happy to put him in the sixth, seventh inning. I'm okay with that. He's a fine setup pitcher. Mm-hmm. I think he gets a bad rap. I think he's a positive relief pitcher. He's not a dominant pitcher by any stretch of the imagination. But I think he's fine. And then you add guys like Josh Tomlin, Sean Newcomb, Grant Dayton. I think what's the young guy's name? Yanoa. I mean, they have plenty of pitchers. They're a couple injuries away from really having an issue, and that's why I would like to see one of those guys get re-signed. I doubt we get both, because I don't think I think both these guys want longer term deals. And after the Marcelo Zuna deal that went through, I don't see the Braves ponying up any.
I also don't like that
large
anyway.
Amount of money.
I think that's just bad strategy. Yeah, I don't like the idea of giving relievers multi-year deals.
If they add anything to the bullpen, it's going to be some guy in like a one, maybe 2 year deal. Just someone to add some depth, a little bit of depth to the bullpen. Where I really see a need is on the offensive side. So the lineup, I think the best guy coming off the bench right now is Johan Camargo, maybe an Ender and Ciarte. Are you comfortable with that? I'm certainly not.
No.
Because I think that was the most potent thing that the LA Dodgers had last year, is the fact that if a guy goes down, they have a guy who's just as good coming up off the bench. And part of that's because they just have this insane spending habit where they just throw money at problems. It's something that the Atlanta Braves are not, and they never will be. But the offensive side, the lineup needs depth. It needs depth, and I don't see that right now. And that, I think, should be the primary concern, more so than the bullpen, because the bullpen, as it stands right now, it's not the best bullpen in baseball like we had last year. But I still see it as like potentially a top five, maybe a top 10, maybe a top five bullpen in all of baseball.
Yeah.
And I'm fine with that, especially with the way they've built up the rotation. But we need to address this lineup. We need depth. Like Hechevarria last year, he's a guy you can just plug in at the middle of the infield. And he's going to play good defense. Ender and Ciarte was like that, but he's coming back. But those are really the only two guys that you have is Johan Camargo and Ciarte. And I'm not really comfortable with that. I don't know who your pinch hitter is.
Nick Markakis, obviously, Garrett.
Nick Markakis signed into a lifetime contract already. I mean, my God.
He's going to get a statue outside of Truist, isn't he? Like, he's going to have something.
Oh, yeah. No, we'll put him right next to Bobby Cox.
Yeah, he's like the Frank Gore of baseball. Like, this dude's just going to keep existing and just be average to below average and just be on teams forever. Like, Nick Markakis has the most Frank Gore-like MLB career. I
love that comp.
That's why people come to this podcast, guys, is for NFL to Major League Baseball comps.
Yeah, exactly.
I would be more okay with Shane Green than Melanson. Melanson's getting up there, and the velocity stuff still scares me, and I'd be more comfortable just adding another guy like Shane Green. And seeing what we have in Will Smith, that's going to be another big thing for this bullpen this year, is what that ultimately looks like. Are we sure, though, on another portion of the Braves part of this? Because Ozuna's back, so we know where he'll be. We know where Acuña will be. But Endiron Cierto has 8 million reasons to be back in Atlanta this year. But Bowman today on MLB.com had a mailbag piece, and he said the Braves are going to give every chance for Christian Pache to be the everyday center fielder, and that's what they ultimately want. Garrett, are you comfortable with giving Pache, if he earns it, like being comfortable going into the year with him being your everyday center fielder?
Well, here, let me start with this. 2 weeks ago, I did say that Marcelo Ozuna was going to be in a Braves uniform, and mm-hmm. I was absolutely,
you're right. There you go.
Absolutely right. let me just take a moment to take full credit for that. But moving on to Christian Pache, I mean, he's a young player. I mean, he's a guy who's going to come in and he's going to play great defense. That's what we know he's going to do. On the offensive side, he's going to struggle. I mean, he showed some flashes against the Dodgers last year. He's a great player. I mean, he has all the talent in the world. I mean, people comped him to Andrew Jones, and I see the comparison. I think it's a great comparison. But at the same time, rookies have their struggles. He needs to be that everyday guy. I trust him to be that, or at least just to show progress throughout the season. I think he's going to do great things. And it's just as much a testament to what he's going to do this year, to what he's going to do in his career, more so than what he's going to do just this year. So he just needs to be that guy. This is the year that he needs to take that step and become that everyday center fielder. But he's also got Endiron Cierto backing him up, who's an elite defender who's going to come in and bat. Well, he's going to bat like 205 or something. So anything to get him off the plate. So Christian Pache, he's going to be the guy. I'm pretty excited for him.
Max, what do you think?
Yeah, I think tempered excitement is probably the right way to put it. I think that's also the right thing for the organization to say, we're going to give this guy every opportunity to win the job. I mean, he's top 10 on Baseball America's top 100 prospects. He's got all the talent in the world. I also think it's important to point out that and sort of temper those expectations by saying we can't have this conversation and say, hey, we really want him to be the center fielder. And then, you know, a few weeks in, if there are struggles, which I'm sure there will be at times, to then say, got to pull the plug. If you make the move with Pache in center field, he's got to sort of have some leash, I think, to figure it out. And I have confidence he will. I mean, I think it's a lot easier of a conversation to have with Ozuna in the fold than without. For that reason, I think I'm with Garrett. I think it's the right move. I think it makes sense. I'm excited to see it.
They're also approaching this in a completely different way than they did earlier in this rebuild, or when it was still a rebuild, when they had Dansby Swanson, who was like, he was in no way, shape, or form ready to come in, up and play Major League Baseball. He was, and everyone like pegs him as the next Chipper Jones, and everyone's like, oh my God, this guy's incredible, and he comes up and hits 225. And then it's like, oh my God, this guy's a bust. What are we doing? Like, we need to get rid of him. And it's like, no, I mean, like he is who he is. He's going to be his own player.
He's Jack Wilson.
And I think, yeah, I mean, he's a good player. I mean, he's a solid player. He's a solid player. And I think Dansby Swanson's gotten better just about every single year. And when he's finally healthy, he's going to play good baseball. And I mean, I think the Braves have gone a different route with Christian Pache. I think they've let him develop at the minor league level. And I think he's going to come up and he's going to play good baseball. But there's also another guy that I think we kind of omitted, who's not really talked about for whatever reasons, Drew Waters.
Yeah.
I mean, he's another guy who's going to be coming up at mm-hmm. some point. I see him making his debut probably June, maybe July, and he's going to be on this roster in September once those rosters expand. And he's another guy who's going to come up and play good baseball. And I'm really excited to see that guy too. I think Pache is a little bit further along, so I think that's why really we're talking about Pache over Waters. But at the same time, I mean, there's a lot of depth in this outfield. Granted, it's very young and unproven. And once these guys get these reps, then this outfield, the sky's the limit. I mean, we could have the best outfield trio in baseball for the next decade, because these three are very, very good. And I think Drew Waters is like, what, a top 20 overall prospect or something? Mm-hmm. And you pair that with Ronald Acuna and another top 10 in Pache.
Well, can I push back on one part of this?
Incredible. Sure.
The idea that the Braves will hit on Pache, Waters, Acuna, Albies, Freeman, and to, I guess, a lesser extent, Dansby. Also, let's just throw in Ian Anderson. Seems very low to me. Like, one of these, like, Austin Riley is just not even, like, think of how we looked at Austin Riley before he got called up and had a year and a half. He was batting the middle of the lineup. We're like, this dude can be protection for Freddie Freeman. And then it's just like, oh, no, this dude just stinks. And his glove is a lot better third, but, like, he's not an everyday player, I don't think, on a really good team. I would not.
I mean, I can't agree with that. He's 23 years old, man.
You're ready?
He's 23.
Wrote him off.
He's 23.
Let's cut through it on this podcast.
No, I have not written him off at all. I've gone to bat for Austin Riley, no pun intended, a few times. I mean, this guy is very talented. I mean, and Chipper Jones came in and was his hitting coach last year. You saw an immediate improvement. Chipper Jones is going to be coming in and he's going to be the, I guess, part-time hitting coach. And I think that's going to do great things for Austin Riley and the rest of this lineup. But
would you at least not be tempted for Riley and Waters for Chris Bryant? Would you not be tempted by that?
No, I don't want Chris Bryant. I'm not
interesting.
Chris Bryant. No, I'm really not.
It would be the best looking infield in Major League Baseball. Chris Bryant and Dansby Swanson on the left side. Like
that would tempt me.
I'm not sold on a guy like Chris Bryant. I mean, he's a guy in the last year of his he's just got signed for a 1 year deal.
Well, I think part of it would just be like it's under the assumption that he is long term, that you pay him long term too.
Yeah, and I don't think the Braves are going to want to pony up and pay him all
which
that
is
money.
Silly.
I just don't.
It's Chris Bryant. What are we doing?
So. But it's the Atlanta Braves.
He's a good player. He's a good player, but the Braves aren't going to pony up and pay him. And then you're looking at trading potentially two guys who are still have years to go before they hit arbitration. And these are two guys who could be so great, so very great. And
a lot of could be.
I understand what could trading for the shoulda, woulda, coulda.
Yep.
Or like what could be for what is. Because you already know what you already know who Chris Bryant is.
Yes.
I mean, he's a good player. He's a World Series MVP winning third baseman. Very good player. Also a very extensive player. And I don't know if I want to trade that potential for Chris Bryant. Now, if I would have a different tone if we're talking Arenado before he got traded.
Yeah.
I would have ponied up and paired these guys in for a guy like that. But Austin Riley, I think he still has some potential left in him. I think he can still be a very good player. Drew Waters, I mean, he still has a lot to prove. And like you mentioned before, it's like you think, are we going to hit on all of these guys? Well, no, probably not. I mean, like there's a good chance that we don't hit on every single one.
Yeah, like one of these three will not be a Brave 3 years from now. Like one of Drew Waters, Christian Pache, and Austin Riley will not be a Brave within 3 years.
Yeah, and then you add in Max Fried and Soroka and all of these other guys who aren't under contract yet. And there are going to be some of these guys. Some of these guys might have to walk because I think Soroka, Fried, Austin Riley, Freeman's got a contract coming up. We've got, and then Dansby Swanson's got a contract coming up. Travis d'Arnaud's got a contract coming up.
But wasn't part of the reason, like,
but
wasn't part of what they were selling with the early extensions for Acuna and Albies was that, like, now we have the money because we saved on these two superstars to spend a lot of money on the Ozunas of the world. Like, that was the idea, right?
That's definitely the idea because I think they're trying to maximize Freddie Freeman's the remaining dominant years of Freddie Freeman. But Max, you go ahead.
Yeah, I just also think that that's a case, I guess, to A, find out what you have in guys like Christian Pache as early as possible and what you don't have. But then sort of once you understand the value here and maybe they hit on all these guys, it's to sort of try to maximize that value as best you can. And I think in baseball and sometimes, especially with a team like the Braves that should be World Series first mindset, maximizing that value means turning in some of the unknown for a known commodity. And I'm not saying Chris Bryant's the perfect fit. He's probably not. But once you understand exactly what you have in Drew Waters and Christian Pache and all these guys, then you can sort of say, okay, how do we maximize all of these guys? Because knowing you're not going to pay all of them.
But then the problem that you run into, Max, is now. like, then their trade value plummets. If whoever they call up and who they bet on and they did not go after the who they are now, those guys, the Bryants, like, once they get called up and they struggle, like the Kaibooms or whoever, then their trade value plummets. And then it's like, it's no longer a prospect. Yeah. It's your, like, the trade value for Austin Riley before he got called up that year versus what he is now is not.
It's like driving a car off the lot.
Yes.
Right? You know, the value drops immediately once they're in the majors.
Kyle Wright's another good example. Also, yeah.
Yeah, but it's also like, maybe you understand what you have in Christian Pache and you really like that and you're willing to roll the dice that Drew Waters is not. Or that he is, and that who you're getting on the receiving end is just that much worth it. Because if your outfield's full, then your outfield's full. It's a good problem to have all around. I mean, it's a really good problem for the Braves to have, and I have faith that they will figure out sort of the best balance of that.
Yeah, I think so. I think we're still moving in the right direction. I know Garrett had like a brain aneurysm seeing that the Braves were posited as a number four team in the NL East this year. Which is just insane.
Freaked out, man.
Yeah, like, it's just anyone who has the stones to put both the Nationals and the Phillies ahead of the Braves is out of their mind. Like, I you could sell me on the Mets, that's about it. But yeah, we shall see. Anything else, guys, outside of JJ Watt in a Photoshop Falcons uniform that you would like to add before we wrap up here?
I'm good.
Ready. He's to not gonna be a Falcon. Atlanta. He's not going to be a Falcon. Like, JJ Watt's not going to be a Falcon. No.
He's going to Pittsburgh, man. That is my. I put money on that. He's going to go play with both of his brothers. I mean, come on. I have two brothers. I would never in a million years pass up the opportunity to go play with both of my brothers, especially if one of my brothers is a Defensive Player of the Year candidate 2 years in a row. I mean, that's only going to elevate my game, and it's going to get him, make him better. I'm just excited. My money is on Pittsburgh.
Interesting. Max, where do you think he goes?
I like Pittsburgh. I Green Bay is worth a shout. Mm-hmm. You know, back to Wisconsin. They could, you know, I don't know. I think that would be a nice fit. But I think it's hard not to see the fit with Pittsburgh. Everyone made the conclusion or the connection with Bill Belichick in New England. I don't think that makes any sense.
Actually,
I don't know. I think
they have
Pittsburgh
money.
Would be fun.
I actually was going to say the Pats.
They do have money.
The Pats actually make a lot of sense for J.J. Watt.
Go on.
I would like they have money, and the Pats, I think, when you listen to what people around the league were saying about the Pats and how Belichick treated this season, that it was just a year he did not give a shit about, that part of me thinks that because they reset the cap and because it was all about resetting the cap, that J.J. Watt's the exact type of Richard Seymour type that he does at this stage and brings in on this defensive line. And I think the Pats are going to be very, very aggressive. And an early way to be very, very aggressive is to sign J.J. Watt to play football for your football team for 6 games before his season's over. So you want to get those 6 games in.
Could they maybe have not given a shit a little bit better and put themselves in a better position to get a quarterback? I don't know who's going to play quarterback for that team.
Jacob Eason, I think. They're going to trade for Jacob Eason.
Man.
Jake Fromm? Who can they get
man.
In there from the SEC? I don't know. I actually have no idea who's going to be under center for the New England Patriots this year.
There are plenty of quarterbacks.
Mac Jones.
Quarterbacks available.
Mac Jones would be a very New England one. And also, his stats are very identical to Tua's at Alabama. Just saying. For that guy down there in Atlanta, Georgia, for that other guy down there in Atlanta, Georgia, Garrett and Max, thank you as always for the time. I greatly appreciate it. We'll be back next Friday, hopefully with J.J. Watt in a Falcons uniform. Who could ever foresee anything else? Guys, thank you so much for the time. Miss Jackson is not the greatest Outkast song. See you later.
Bye, guys. Cheers.
All right, we're back on a Friday afternoon edition of Volcanic Takes, a very good Tennessee podcast on the CT podcast. It's Friday, so that's what we do. First timer, though, David Sheely is here. David, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
I'm good. How you doing?
I'm good. So I've learned that you are an alumnus from Georgia State University. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. That is correct.
Okay, so I am an alumnus undergrad for the University of North Georgia. So I'm actually a Georgia native as well. Are you from Georgia?
I am from Georgia. Yeah, I lived there as a kid. I mean, I moved a lot of places, but the two places I spent a lot of time was Georgia and Indiana. So I spent about the same amount of time there coming up. And I went, of course, I went to college in downtown Atlanta at Georgia State. So those are kind of like my two homes, but Georgia is like my first home.
Interesting. So the Adderholt building, you're all about it.
Not the walk there, because I mean, it's honestly like going to Adderholt is like trying to deliver the Krusty Krab pizza, because it's like it's super windy, uh-huh. And if it's cold outside, then it's like negative 10 degrees trying to go over there because the wind chill. So like, I did not like going to Adderholt.
Interesting. I went there for 1 year, my sophomore year of school. So
okay,
yeah, did not. I was not a big fan. I lived it obviously downtown for 5 years after I graduated, but. George State, I don't know. It just wasn't the right feel for me. Also here in my locality, I think we're all local now. We're all Knoxville people at this point. Ryan Shumpert of the University of Tennessee, Daily Beacon. Ryan, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Nobody builds 5G like Verizon builds 5G, because we're the engineers who built the most reliable network in America. And the more you do with 5G, the more building it right matters, the more your network matters. The more Verizon engineers going the extra mile matters. It's us pushing us. It's Verizon versus Verizon. 5G built right from America's most reliable network. Most reliable based on rankings from RootMetrics second half 2020 U.S. report of 3 mobile networks. Results may vary. Award is not an endorsement.
Doing pretty well. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being here, man. Sorry, we didn't know going in that you would be the lone Tennessee native on this podcast. You've gotten used to Trey.
I didn't. Yeah, I didn't expect to be outnumbered, but pretty quickly, 2-1 from the Atlanta over Nashville.
That's how it should be, in all honesty. Atlanta, noted better city, southern city, than Nashville, Tennessee. Everyone knows it. We all believe it. It is actually how it works. This week in Knoxville, guys. Ryan, what have you seen this week around town? Anything interesting?
Nothing overly interesting. It feels like we're sitting here trying to tackle a lot of the same questions we were trying to tackle last week and what Josh Heupel's staff's going to look like. I think the Tennessee basketball team found a little bit of an identity since the last time we talked, so that's been a little more exciting for people around here. But overall, still a lot of question marks about Heupel's staff, what that's going to look like, and kind of a wait-and-see game right now.
Absolutely, and we'll get into that in just a second. David, what about you? Have you been around and seeing what's up with Knoxville in the last week?
Well, I think we're getting kind of close to that high school basketball tournament time. Some of the Division II schools are already starting up when it comes to the high school basketball playoffs, and that's always exciting. You know, kind of what Ryan was saying. We still don't know what Coach Heupel's staff is going to look like when it comes to the University of Tennessee. You know, nothing official yet. Definitely a lot of, you know, stuff that's been reported, but nothing official yet. And I guess it is believed that he will announce the entire staff at one point. So, like, all the names will just drop at one point, and we'll just have a list of coaches. So that'll be pretty interesting there. And then, you know, basketball team is doing pretty well. Mm-hmm. Both the men's and women's teams. I think the finding some consistency has been kind of the theme for both teams this year. But today is also the start of spring sports, or I guess to say the diamond sports, because the softball team has a doubleheader today, starting their 2021 season, and we're a week away from Tennessee baseball.
I'm excited for Tennessee baseball. I'm going to go to as many games as possible. As someone who grew up on college baseball, especially downtown, going to Georgia Tech games when my grandfather went to Tech. I still think that's like the best college baseball venue, but just the skyline of Atlanta. I don't know. David, have you been to one in Georgia Tech baseball game?
I have not been to a Georgia Tech baseball game. I've been to games that Georgia Tech played in on other campuses, but I have not been to their baseball stadium. But I've seen plenty of college baseball because I covered all the sports teams at Georgia State, so that included baseball, that included softball. And, of course, now here I've been to a bunch of Tennessee baseball and softball games, but Georgia Tech baseball was the one team that I did not get to see play at home.
Interesting, interesting. We should also mention David works for WBIR Sports, so he does great work there, so check out WBIR BIR if you're not already in the great state of Tennessee. Guys, we got to talk about the latest in the defensive coordinator search. Just reading the room and my uncles and all my Tennessee family and friends losing their minds about this. All of them, what I've noticed is there is a direct correlation between boomers who want Kevin Steele and everybody else who's like, ah, it's fine. We don't have to keep Kevin Steele on. It's more complicated than that. And I don't know if this is something that y'all have noticed, the difference between, well, he's getting paid to do a job. Let's just do it for a year and everything else. And, like, let's just run it with him. I don't understand why we wouldn't just make him do it. Ryan, what do you make of that assumption?
Well, you know, it's definitely a popular one out there. And I think there's some reasons schematically that it's not a great fit with Heupel, but I think those people who are screaming it at the top of their lungs to hire him, I think they feel more empowered and more right as Tennessee, as long as this search keeps on going on. Appears that Tennessee got turned down by Al Washington. I don't think any of that's officially official, but a lot of still uncertainty or really can't get anyone to take the job. And when you have a veteran defense coordinator in-house already getting paid that you're going to have to pay a buyout to if you don't keep them on staff, which doesn't seem likely. People are kind of understandably frustrated, but like you said, I don't think it's as simple as that. And it's an important hire and someone that Heupel has to get that fits what he wants to do and where he wants to take this program.
David, what do you think?
Yeah, there's layers to this. There's got to be. If it was as simple as, hey, this guy's been hired, whoever the head coach is, this guy's going to be on the defensive staff. Well, you know, I feel like that would have been a bad deal for the head coach to come in and say, hey, we already got your defensive guy lined up for you. Don't even worry about it. And he doesn't get to say so. Well, he's running the program. You know, I think it's not a very wise idea to tell a guy, hey, this is your program except for this one part. So I think there are layers to that. Now, you know, everything like the details and all that, I'm not going to pretend that I know all those. I don't, but it's still not official yet who anybody is anywhere on the staff. You know, I check the website all the time to see if anybody's been officially announced. Josh Heupel is listed as the only coach. That is it. He's the only coach listed there, and it doesn't look like that's changing for at least another week or so. So I just, you know, I'm kind of wondering when that's going to happen. I do know that Tennessee does plan to have an orange and white game. And so, but in order to start really working on the details of that, they need a coaching staff. So they only have so much time at this point.
When do you think the orange and white game is going to happen?
They usually happen in like April. So I would say April.
Well, you know that they definitely wanted to announce the DC Wednesday. Like, that was definitely the plan, is they wanted to do the whole staff by the middle of this week, and that clearly did not happen. And I don't think that's an embarrassing thing, but it did seem like that was where they were trending, right?
Yeah, and you know, the only reason I was so curious about the orange and white game is because by now we usually have an announcement of when it's going to happen. Like, by now, we should know. You know, it was so quick to get a head coach, but the time period of, like, waiting to see if Pruitt was going to get fired was so long. And I feel like we're just in another phase of that again, where it's like, well, we know at some point something's going to happen. Either there's going to be an announcement that he stays or he gets fired, but we know something's going to happen eventually. Same thing here. We know there's going to have to be a coaching staff, but, you know, we don't know when that's going to come. We don't know, you know, but eventually it'll happen. I'm just being as patient as I can, because it's just about, you know, when.
Yeah, for sure. Ryan, do you have a leader?
Well, jump in here. One thing I was going to add onto what David was saying on the spring game, something I'd watch for there is I wonder if schools think they may open up recruiting in the spring, whether that be in April or May, is things start to get better. I think there's been some thought that may happen. So I think there may be a little bit of, now obviously Tennessee doesn't have a coaching staff, so they probably wouldn't have their spring date set anyway. But I think you may see some hesitation as teams kind of wait and maybe push back spring games into May if that's when things get opened in recruiting, just so they can bring people on campus, show them some sort of a game atmosphere after not getting able to do that at all last fall.
Interesting. Yep.
And who's to say there's not some FCS coaches that Heupel may want? And the FCS teams are about to play seasons, you know? There's about to be a whole spring football season, I think, starting this weekend or next weekend.
Yeah, there's a game this weekend. I think it's like McNeese State, or if I'm not mistaken, is playing this
weekend. Yeah, there's like a bunch of FCS football that's about to happen. So there may be some guys there that Coach Heupel's looking at that are kind of occupied right now.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Who do you – like, if Al Washington, we can cross him off, and I Heupel and Danny White deserve some sort of gigantic breadbasket from Washington for the amount of money they have made him in the last 2 weeks. So I'm interested to see how Al Washington returns the favor, at least a good fruit basket, something for the gigantic pay raise that he's pushed Ohio State into. You love to see it, folks. But Casey Rogers seems like someone that they're talking to and interesting. And, you know, he played at Tennessee, and also he coaches the defensive line at Tampa Bay, who just won the Super Bowl, and Tampa Bay won the Super Bowl in large part because of what Shaq Barrett and Jason Pierre-Paul and Vita Vea did on the defensive line against Patrick Mahomes and those bad offensive linemen. What do you make of that? And then also the Rodney Gardner addition and what that might mean on the defensive line, because those two don't seem to be connected, but it is interesting that the rumored DC target is a defensive line guy, and they just hired a defensive line coach. David, what do you think?
Well, yeah, so speaking on Rodney Gardner, because that's what I know the most about, just from, you know, reports and talking to some people. I mean, the guy, he knows what a winning team looks like, because he's been in the locker room of winning teams. He's been in the locker room of a winning Tennessee team. And he's also a really good recruiter. And that's really what Tennessee needs. They need coaches who can recruit the right way, just based off of everything that's happened. And they've got to be able to have some integrity in there, like Coach Heupel wanted and like Danny White wants. You got to have some integrity there. And I definitely think Coach Gardner brings that. He's well respected in the SEC. He's familiar with the SEC. And that's something that people have kind of, you know, knocked Heupel for. It's like, hey, you've been in the SEC, but you haven't been a head coach in the SEC. And now you're going to be consistently playing Georgia, Florida, Alabama, and it's going to be tough. Well, Heupel knows the line of scrimmage is super important. So you get a guy like Gardner who knows the line of scrimmage very, very well in the SEC and knows how to get his guys ready. And has recruited the players that have succeeded here in this conference and in Tennessee. I think this is probably one of the sleeper hires that's been reported so far. And that's the one to really look for. That defensive line for Tennessee is going to be really important, because they're going to be playing some really beefy offensive lines. I mean, that's just how the SEC goes. You got to beef up that offensive line, and this hire should really help them out.
Ryan, what do you think?
Yeah, on Gardner, there's two things that stand out. One, just what David was talking about, the SEC ties. The people who have been reported on his staff right now, not a ton of SEC ties, not a ton of SEC experience. There's no one with more experience recruiting the SEC than Rodney Gardner, and there's no one with more experience recruiting the state of Georgia than Rodney Gardner, which is going to be incredibly important for Josh Heupel. And then number two, I think he's a really good on-the-field coach. And you look at Tennessee's defensive line, they took a big step back from two seasons ago under Tracy Rocker to last season with four games under Jimmy Brumbaugh and then Jeremy Pruitt coming in. If Tennessee is going to make a jump and surprise some people next year, defensive line's kind of position on the defense, at least, I think, has some talent and really underachieved last year. So it's going to be important right away for him to get in there and see if he can get some instant results. And then on Casey Rogers, I wouldn't think it's a huge deal that they hired a defensive line coach, especially when it was someone with the pedigree that Rodney Gardner has. But Casey Rogers, it's interesting because he's got a lot of great NFL experience. Does he want to come back to college? Hasn't coached in college since 2002 when he was at Arkansas. Obviously, Tennessee is his alma mater. And then the one kind of question mark there, only one stint as a defensive coordinator, and that was under Todd Bowles. So, you know, Todd Bowles had his fingerprints all over that defense. So he doesn't have a ton of experience running his own defense. That would be the one kind of question mark on him. But a ton of coaching experience and where Tennessee is at in this coaching search, I think they could definitely do a lot worse than him.
Yeah. Where do you think this ultimately goes, David? Who do you think is ultimately the defensive coordinator this fall in Knoxville?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I'm not sure. And you know, it's hard for me to really guess. I mean, I didn't expect Josh Heupel to be the head coach. Mm. So
who were you expecting?
You know, that Tony Elliott.
Oh, interesting.
I thought they were going to be able to swing Tony Elliott, and that's just because, like, Danny White knows how to find different coaches that, you know, can just that they win. Like, they just have these characteristics and they win. So I was like 75% sure that Tony Elliott was going to be the guy. And that's because I didn't think Heupel was going to leave UCF. I didn't think that was like, I was like, that's probably not going to happen. But you know,
do you think the reason Elliott didn't happen is just because of the uncertainty surrounding the investigations and what the penalties will actually be? Do you think if it was a clean slate, he's the guy?
I'm sure that was a situation with a lot of coaches.
Yeah.
I mean, I've heard that they spoke to a lot of coaches in a lot of places. It was truly a nationwide search. It was really a nationwide search, and they just, I mean, we don't know what the NCAA is going to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have no idea what the punishment for Tennessee is going to be, you know, postseason ban, losing scholarships, you know, all kind of stuff. But right now, you know, I feel like, to answer that question, I feel like that was the reason Tony Elliott didn't want to come, just like all the other coaches. Had it been a clean slate, I think Pruitt would have probably got one more year. Just because it was like, hey guys, it was a pandemic year. We didn't get spring. We didn't do this. You know, Harrison Bailey ended up coming on at the end of the season. We got a chance here with him. You know, give him a full off season, and if we still aren't producing, okay, then I can go. And I feel like he would have been able to swing that if it was a totally clean slate and nobody was in trouble. I don't think Tennessee would have had a coaching search.
Hmm, that's interesting. Ryan, what do you think of all of that?
I think there's a lot of truth in that, and I think it's the question that no one really knows, but the overlying question was, did Tennessee make this really go into this recruiting violations and really dig into the investigation and pay the top-notch lawyers because they were concerned about illegal recruiting, or were they doing that because they didn't want to pay Jeremy Pruitt his buyout? And that's the question. Obviously, Tennessee would never say that the latter is the case, and obviously that's what Jeremy Pruitt and his lawyer has said, and mm-hmm. I don't think anyone knows what the answer to that question is. But so you just don't know. But I would say that if that was the case, if that was the thought process, let's not pay, let's do an investigation and not have to pay Pruitt his buyout. I think that has proven over the coaching search and how long they've delayed things and how the coaching search has gone for the defense coordinator. I think that's proven to be a very poor decision. Made the job and the defense coordinator job right now a lot less desirable with the cloud of the NCAA hanging over things.
I will tell you, talking to my former coach about, because you and I, Ryan, have talked about Cody Brown and what's going on there. I think this is a sentiment among a lot of guys who've signed their intent or in the portal, is that like some of them might come back if this is cleared up. They just know what the sanctions are. And part of it is just like, why would we go here when the sanctions are limited or just not available? Like, why would we keep our letter of intent, because this is not what we signed up for? It's not necessarily an indictment on the coaching staff. And I think they would be able to keep a lot of these guys like the Cody Browns if they were able to just get it out in the open of what it is, because like Chandler's gone, Gray's gone. Like, there's an easy opportunity for Cody Brown to get a bunch of snaps at running back right away. It's just more of like, are we going into a situation where I can't play in a bowl game for 3 years? Like, that is something they have to wonder. And it's like, why would we still want to go here? Why would Henry Toa come back if they don't even know what the DC situation looks like? Like, there's just so much uncertainty that I do think needs to be wrapped up sooner rather than later, because I think it permeates through recruiting, through the guys in the portal, through the rest of the coaching staff, the university itself. Like, the sooner we can wrap this up, the better. The offensive side of the ball, though, does seem to be wrapped up. Jeremy Mack is added to the offensive room. What do you make of that hire away from Rice, David?
You know, I think, again, it's another one of those, you know, pretty good hires. And he's a former head coach. I think that's also pretty important. Being a head coach and then being an associate head coach at Rice, somebody who knows offenses, right? You gotta, if you're going to be on this staff, this offensive staff, you've got to really know offense, because this is a fast-paced offense. It's an offense that likes to spread defenses around, that likes to look at matchups and figure out how to exploit those, and then just really frustrate defenses with similar looks but different plays. So I feel like that's another pretty decent hire. It's just, man, that you look at that offense, and it's just been decimated. You were kind of alluding to it earlier. That offensive line, not just from the transfer portal, but just guys who aren't returning, you know, Trey Smith, you know, he's going to the NFL draft. And then you have Brandon Kennedy. He's out, you know, he's done. He's played in college for a long time. So he felt like, hey, it's time to move on. So
Wanya Morris,
I actually take a look. Wanya Morris is Oklahoma. Jameer Johnson is gone. It's a lot of offensive talent there that's out of here. That's a lot. And you take a look at that starting offensive line from the game against South Carolina, they're pretty much all gone. And actually, if you think about it, Wanya Morris did not start that game. He saw action, but he did not even start that game. And still, most of that starting offensive line is gone. So they're going to have to do some work there. And, you know, it's you can be a good running back, but a good running back with a bad offensive line is just an average running back. So that's where they really need the help at. You know, who's going to be the offensive lineman coach? Who's going to try to, you know, come – who can recruit offensive linemen to kind of come and fix what happened there? Because I'm a guy who likes watching good running backs, but I understand that good running backs can only do so much if their offensive line is not good, especially in the SEC.
Ryan, what do you think?
Yeah, my kind of looking at it was kind of on a lesser degree, but some of the same things with Gardner is that he's got a lot of Southern ties. Now, he hasn't recruited at a lot of big schools, but he's coached in Memphis, Central Arkansas, Arkansas Pine Bluff, South Alabama. So he's been in the high schools in the South. He knows coaches. He has a relationship with coaches. So I think that plays well for, like I said, a coaching staff that doesn't have a ton of Southern ties. And the fact he's from Memphis, coached in Memphis, I would think we've heard Josh Heupel make a big statement about what they're going to do in the state of Tennessee and how important that is. And I imagine Memphis is very important to that. And I'd imagine Jerry Mack will have a very prominent role in recruiting Memphis.
Interesting. Well, speaking of Memphis, Joe Doyle transferring to Memphis. Should we be in panic mode about the departure of Doyle to Memphis?
There have been so many people depart this offseason. I wouldn't be throwing the panic button or slamming the panic button at Joe Doyle leaving, but
no,
certainly a little bit of a loss, I guess.
Absolutely, absolutely. Basketball. Let's talk about Tennessee basketball. That is on the upswing. It's been a great week for Keon Johnson and Jaden Springer. Obviously, their second half in the Kentucky game was incredible, and just them taking that next step that was sorely needed on this Tennessee roster to get them back on track, especially offensively. David, what do you make of Keon and Springer breaking through against not only Kentucky but also Georgia, highlighted by that poster from Keon Johnson?
I'm still trying to get over that dunk, man. That was insane. You know, top play on SportsCenter. The reactions on social media and I wish it was a packed arena when that happened. I really do. And it's unfortunate, man, that there weren't a bunch of people just packing that arena to really react to that, because I feel like that probably would have been one of the loudest I've ever heard Thompson Bowling. Mind you, I've only been here for 2.5 basketball seasons. Or really, I guess it was 2 basketball seasons, because I came in the second half of that year when they were, you know, they had Grant Williams and Schofield and Jordan Bone. And now this season here. So Yeah, I mean, that dunk was insane. What we're seeing here is that two freshmen who are really, really good, okay, came in top, some of the top recruits in the entire country, and now they're comfortable in the system. They're comfortable, they have an understanding, and they're starting to, the game is starting to slow down for them. And you can tell it's starting to slow down for them. So the offense should now work through them. I understand they want to work inside out and they want to do everything, but honestly, you look at it, the offense should be let Keon and Springer attack and make the defense answer to that. And if they can't, okay, then you can adjust and do whatever you need to do. But right now, you need to put the ball in the hands of your playmakers, and that's Johnson and Springer. And that is the formula that's been working in the past couple of games. You let them make their plays. You let them play their game. Now that they're comfortable, earlier in the season, you know, they weren't – they're still, you know, trying to figure things out. That's why when Tennessee was in some tight games early, they weren't getting those minutes, and it's because they had – like, Barnes wasn't sure if they could be in that situation just yet. But now, yeah. I mean, they need to be, you know, game on the line. You need to play. You need to work those two into that game-winning play. That's how it needs to go for the rest of the season through the NCAA tournament. Those two are the focal point of your offense.
Absolutely. I agree. Ryan, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree 100%. And the thing I think you've seen the last two games to kind of go along with it, I think it's an interesting look, is obviously against Kentucky, Fulkerson got into a lot of foul trouble and played 10 minutes. Pons didn't play Wednesday night against Georgia. Tennessee ran a lot of four-guard lineups, and it made the offense look significantly, significantly better. And especially the way that Keon Johnson and Jaden Springer want to play, they want to get downhill, they want to drive to the basket. Being able to space the floor like that, I think, makes that a lot easier for them, and it makes it a lot easier to run in transition. Now, the question is, at some point, Tennessee's not a very good rebounding team to begin with. Now, if you're playing four guards, that's going to get worse. When do they run into teams that can make them pay for running that four-guard lineup and force them to kind of go back and play big? When they do that, like David said, I would still expect them to play through Johnson and Springer, but I think that limits a little bit of the ceiling, at least offensively, for his team.
Yeah, Fulkerson is like the odd man out here, but like you need his offensive rebounding so much, and his rebounding is the one thing keeping him there. And I don't know, man. Like I think, like you said, you have to be versatile. You have to be able to match up depending on, like, there's part of it where they're going to run into teams that are more talented, like the Baylors, the Gonzagas, whoever, the Michigans, where they are going to impose their will on Tennessee, and Tennessee has to respond. Tennessee will be able to survive in the SEC tournament playing four-guard lineups for the most part. I think they unlocked something that should be fine, but I don't know. I go back and forth on this because this is modern basketball, and this is like how they probably should have been playing all along, but I don't know. Like, part of me is like, I'd rather them just live and die by the four-guard lineup and close and don't bend and be like, hey, we got to play big because Team X is a bigger team. Like, no, trust your young guys and your guards to be able to overpower them and run their bigs off the floor. Like, that's more of what I would do. I don't know if Rick Barnes is comfortable leading a small lineup to be like, hey, see if you can stop us. We know we're going to kill them the glass, but we're also going to outscore you and outshoot you. So we'll let the chips fall where they may. David, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I think we look at this this team, and about a month ago, really earlier, a little bit earlier into this month, we saw some inconsistencies, you know, and we know this team can win. We know this team can win a game. That Kentucky game is an example of that. But look, they've got a formula. They've unlocked this new level. Now, I'll tell you what, some of the issues that Tennessee has had is when teams can just knock down shots. Like we look at the, like I look at that Ole Miss game. I look at that Florida game. What are you going to do when teams knocking them down? You know, you can't control that. So that's something to look for. But other than that, this team is, I said earlier in the season, I said this team has Sweet 16, Elite Eight potential. But they've got to stay out of foul trouble. They've got to be smart with their minutes. And they've got to be disciplined. There's some games where the discipline is just gone. And it's a head scratcher. It's a really head scratcher when that happens. But this team, I really think that they can make some noise now. They can really make some noise. That win over Kansas was kind of a statement, but they've got to come with that same energy.
Absolutely, Ryan. Any final thoughts on Tennessee's last two games and where they're going forward?
Yeah, I think what David was saying is something that's going to be really interesting to watch down the stretch. The teams that can spread it out, attack, and shoot the three, those are the teams that could kill Tennessee. Alabama did it. Arkansas did it. Obviously, Arkansas didn't win that game, but they scored a lot of points on Tennessee. With this four-guard lineup, Tennessee can do a lot more of the switching and the stuff that Rick Barnes wants to do. And a lot of those games, and I think the Auburn game is going to be a perfect test to watch. So we've seen it the past few years. Auburn has gotten switches, and they've attacked with their guards against Tennessee's bigs, and they've really tried to attack glass. Can Tennessee, with this four-guard lineup, kind of stop some of that stuff that Auburn wants to do, Alabama wants to do, those kind of high-octane offenses? Because that's really what they've struggled with under Barnes and the style of defense they play. But I feel like now, with, you know, potentially going small, they have the weapons to stop it a little bit more.
Absolutely. And quickly, guys, the SEC, like we talked about, the Vols baseball team will be back soon. Preseason predictions seem to heavily favor the Vols and the SEC. Ryan, why should we be excited about Tennessee baseball being back?
Well, it's their highest preseason prediction, third in the SEC's highest prediction since 2005 when they hosted a regional, made it to the College World Series. And I think that's kind of the goal for this team. See if they can, not the College World Series, that was probably a little misleading. See if they can host a regional. They got back to the NCAA tournament 2 years ago. They would have been in the NCAA tournament last season. They hadn't gotten canceled. And a lot of, you know, they lost three really important players. But besides that, everyone back on a team that was really good last year, led the nation in runs, was second in home runs. So it should be exciting to watch. They have some question marks that weekend rotation that they have to figure out. But they have an offense that should be able to carry the load, especially in the pre-conference slate.
David, what do you think?
Yeah, they've got some of the bats. Like they've got the bats. I'm not necessarily worried about that. But like Ryan was saying, it's that pitching. You know, what's the bullpen situation like? What's the rotation going to be like? You know, they lost some really really good players in that rotation over the past couple of years, and they've also lost some really good players that were in the outfield. And there are some teams in the SEC that can really hit the ball. And I look at the SEC, and I say this conference play is going to be huge for what Tennessee's success will be in the season. You know, looking at some of the rankings, Tennessee, yeah, are they a top 25 team? Yeah, they are. But the conference seems ahead of them, like South Carolina's ahead of them. I know Arkansas's ahead of them. LSU, Mississippi State, Vandy. I think Florida is ranked number one. There's a lot of powerhouse teams here in the SEC, and that's like if Tennessee was like in any other conference, like if they were like in the Big Ten or something, it was like this is their conference to lose. But being in the SEC, it's more like even though you're ranked, they still have to prove themselves. So that's the one thing that I'm going to be looking at, like how do they go through SEC play, because that's a gauntlet.
For sure.
One thing I'll add on there: no pitchers that have made any career SEC starts. So they have some bodies there. They have some solid guys, but who can step up and be a top end weekend starter is very much a question going into the season.
Yep.
All right, David. How can we check you out here in Knoxville?
Sure. You can follow me on Twitter. That is Deacon_Sheely. Sheely is SCHIELE. And you can also catch me on YouTube. I got a gaming channel that is Five Wars Deke. So five, just spell out the number, or spell it. Yeah, I guess spell out the number, five, and then Wars, and then DEAC. Five Wars Deke. That's on YouTube. I do some breakdowns via video games, also just kind of some like franchise modes and whatnot. But that's if you want to keep up with what I'm doing, that's the best way to do it.
All right, Ryan. What about you?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at rshump00, rschump00.
All right, go do that. Guys, thank you so much for the time. I greatly appreciate it. Stay safe out there, and maybe we'll see each other around these Knoxville streets.
Sounds good, man.
Yeah, for sure. Appreciate you having me.
All right, we're good. David, that was great. Great work, man.
All right. Yeah, no problem, man.
All right. Well, Ryan, David, I appreciate the time. As always, got to jump on the next one, but I'll have this up in a little bit, and I'll link you on all that good stuff.
Yeah, for all sure. Right. Appreciate it. Good all time, right. guys.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Take care, man.
What about that Kentucky running game in 2020? Chase Thomas mentioned it to me this week. Y'all know Chase Thomas, Chase Thomas podcast, link, description, sub, listen. And when he brought it up, I was like, yeah, I need to go back and learn a little bit about how things went this past season in Lexington, because honestly, I wasn't able to see many of their games. Let's take a look, see what we can find.
Wyatt gets the ball. Wyatt back to throw. Wyatt look. Wyatt toward the end zone.
What's up, y'all? I'm Matt Wyatt, former player, now broadcaster, helping you get more enjoyment watching football. Welcome back to the channel. Kentucky's offense was obviously built around their run game this year in 2020.
On third and one, it's Rodriguez to the end zone. Touchdown.
Rodriguez, the running back, was the leading rusher, but not the only contributor. And Terry Wilson, the quarterback, was top three, which speaks to the scheme that they use, which was primarily a zone running offense where the quarterback has a lot of reads and can keep the ball some. Hold the backside honest, all that.
Rodriguez, he can take this to El Dorado.
The numbers compared to 2018, a year when they had Benny Snell and a healthy Terry Wilson at quarterback. They averaged 199 yards a game that year and just under 5 yards per carry. Here in 2020, Terry Wilson, healthy again, and they averaged 196 rushing yards a game and 5 yards per carry, just like 2018. Now, I skipped over 2019 because the injuries at quarterback forced them to be almost exclusively a running offense with Lynn Bowden, a converted receiver, playing quarterback. So those numbers are skewed. 2018 and 2020 were, I thought, better comparisons.
Not look good for the guy that's just been there. Their catalyst on offense. Big hole here. Speaking of catalyst, Chris Rodriguez in the open field. Can he get to the end zone? Yes, he will. Touchdown, Kentucky.
This season, the numbers pretty much tell the story for the Kentucky offense. Only three games, opponents held them under 100 yards rushing. Those were Mississippi State, Missouri, and Alabama. They had four games where they went over 200 yards rushing as a team, including over 300 against Vandy and over 400 yards rushing against Ole Miss. And to frame the whole thing up, as good as the running game was, they only had two games where they went over 200 yards passing. But even more telling regarding the lack of balance, five games where they were held under 100 yards passing, which was a reason they finished the year with only five wins. And here's one in that bowl game. They're going out the left side. They ran behind this left side of that offensive line all day in this particular game. And there's a couple things you notice. They split it. Corner misses. He runs through the safety. Big run for a first down. You know, again, there are a lot of these plays where you can watch this mesh point of the quarterback running back and try to guess, okay, is he reading something? Some are more obvious, and without being in the huddle or in the meeting room, I don't necessarily always know if it's straight give or read on some of these, but we can definitely look at how it's blocked. And again, it's zone steps against a three-man defensive front. A couple of things I noticed, though, it's sort of isolating three defenders, okay, two on the line of scrimmage and that linebacker, okay, so those three defenders kind of isolating them against three blockers, and they're going, hey, we're just going to bet in this zone scheme. We can get numbers like 3-on-3. We're going to run behind it because we have confidence. So watch how they block it. Center snaps. He's taking the nose, trying to get his head to the left, you know, take him head up or at least get leverage around to his left shoulder of the center. Guard tackle are technically, I think, what is a combo up to that play side linebacker right there. And what happens is pretty simple. Center takes the nose, tackle winds up getting inside leverage on the tackle. And so then it's run right behind that left guard who's going to step up right here on that play side linebacker. And here comes the hole, and there it is. Okay, so the left tackle's block is huge. He's just clearing it out. Center is huge, got the nose inside, and there's your hole right here. And as you see, the guard's in it, that silver helmet's in it. I'm following him. as a running back. You're going to follow him. Now, one thing that's interesting, they corner blitzed on this side. The ball was on the left hash, or near it anyway. And so he felt like he's boundary corner, and he's corner blitzing, firing, and watch. The receiver sees this. I can't block him. And he's like, you're not going to let him know, but he's pointing, actually pointing at the corner, say, hey, he's coming. And you don't have somebody to account for him in the blocking scheme because the up back on this side is coming to take care of the backside defensive end where that end man can't run this play down from the backside. So the hole's there. The guard has stepped up on that linebacker, but now we got a corner who has stepped into the hole, unblocked, we're running right at him. And I've said this a lot in these films. If you're an SEC running back, you got to make him miss every time, over him or through him, one or the other. And look, it's just a big old wide hole. That offensive line has cleared it out. Back is in there one-on-one against a corner, and the corner never even gets a finger on him. I mean, he's stepping into the hole unblocked. Not only misses a tackle, just steps in there and looks at him and never even touched him. A really poor job by the corner. And then this is a safety coming up right here. We're going to meet him and stop him for a first down. And again, a running back's going to run in through and break that tackle, take three defenders across the first down stick. Really physical running game. Here's one I think you're reading if you're the quarterback. Again, it looks like it. Don't know the call, but I'm looking at his eyes and looking at the way it's blocked. And I think they are treating this like a four-man front, even though this defender is sort of removed. He's out here a good bit, but I think they're treating this like four and two against four wide receivers in sort of a man-free look, something to that effect. So four and two, if you got nickel personnel, it means there's a safety out here somewhere, which I'm pretty sure there is. We just can't see him on screen. Here's what I say. It looks like read. When you snap it, they're taking that guy with his hand down there with the tackle and trying to turn him this way outside so as to make room for this give. Again, we're just kind of manning up. There's a combo happening here, center, left guard, up to the linebacker, similar to the last play. Left tackle's going one-on-one against that. And I think what you're doing is reading that end man on the line of scrimmage, which you're treating him that way as unblocked. If he were to fly down inside right here, I think you got a chance for the quarterback to keep the ball right here. And it's either keep it and run or RPO, one or the other. But if he stays outside or if I feel like he's too far outside on alignment, I'm going to give. Now, how does the end play it? He's coming down there like sort of crashing right at the mesh point. Now, he's not lateral this way. He's sort of upfield right at the mesh point. And I think slow playing it. And I think really, too, again, as I said, kind of he's sort of removed to begin with out here on the hash. It may even be a pre-snap read for the quarterback that unless he flies down inside, I'm giving this football because you have what you want. Again, center takes care of nose, tackles there. Now we got this big hole created back here for the back to get past the line of scrimmage with the guard up on the linebacker. And this time we got a block on the outside as well. And out we go. So just zone blocking and being more physical up front. Here's another one out the backside, but it's blocked a little differently. As we said, there's a lot in this game for Kentucky. They kind of lived on the left hash into that boundary. And this one's a little different. This is a little bit more like just running power. Now, it may be a read involved. Again, could be. It has that look with a fourth on the line of scrimmage. Quarterback's going to snap it, and you can tell mesh point, and I'm looking here in man line of scrimmage. But you're also pulling backside guard, it's pulling the right guard to the left and pulling back in there and leading this run with a linebacker and an up back. With a lineman and an up back. And in this case, you look again how it's blocked back there where they're coming from. Different from those other plays we saw. Again, three-man front, you got a nose, and now you've got an inside shade on that defensive lineman here, the defensive tackle, inside shoulder of the tackle. So they're going to block this down and push it this way as opposed to those other zone blocking where we, blocked him to the outside. Just going to use where he is to our advantage. And in this case, boom, hit him, drive him this way. Center left guard are up on the nose, up to the linebacker, which I believe is going to be backside linebacker. And play side, you've got guard pulling, finding the first one outside, tight end pulling, finding the linebacker inside, play side linebacker, boom, those two blocks happen, and there it is. So you get everything washed down here. You get pullers that pull and wash everything outside, and so there is your hole. Now, it looks elementary when you slow it down. When you think about it, it's all these big bodies running full speed in about a second and a half to make it happen. It's pretty impressive how consistent their run game was. Here's direct snap on the goal line, and this was a thing for them throughout the year, and why not? You know, show the defense something different. Don't waste time on a handoff. You know, you look too at how they've got the formation set. It's, you know, the five linemen, two tights on one side on a line of scrimmage and up back, and then another tight up back too. So it's a big heavy package, only one receiver and quarterback kind of splitting out here to see if you can draw a defense, make them think. Blocking everything, zone back this way, up back, come out, kick out the in-man line of scrimmage, just get him to the goal line and you're in. Here's more of that running to the left. This time it kind of splits out the backside of what they're reading right here. And again, the reason I say read, I think it's pretty obvious. You know, you look on alignment, okay, this is four wides. You look on alignment, that play side defensive tackle in a three-man front is actually head up or inside of the offensive tackle. So on the snap, they're anticipating this linebacker coming up and treating him like the in-man line of scrimmage if he steps up there. And that's what happens. And I'm pretty sure you can tell that his eyes are on, are on this linebacker, going to watch him and see what his movement is. Quarterback's meshing, reading. So we're blocking down that way. He's stepping up, but he's slow to get there, and he stays to the outside. And with that, you know, he's not, my picture moved here. He's not, you know, flying in here to try to cut this off or going inside. I think if he does, again, quarterback probably pulls it and runs, or you have RPO. But because he's sort of hanging out here by himself on the in-man line of scrimmage, it's a give. You know, it turns into a give. So I think it is a read involved. And the reason you pop this one, again, is you're dependent on those bigs up front, and they're comboing this time right guard and center, or comboing center up to linebacker. And you get a nice one-on-one block by the tackle. Okay, so way more physical right here on the edge defender. Guard center have this knocked up into the linebacker really well. And so there you split it. And there's nobody at the next level because one linebacker is blocked. Another is to the outside. A quarterback accounted for him. And if he gets in here and it takes, you know, again, it's like 3-on-3 football. And we're depending on winning that every single time. And you really saw that a bunch in their run game, depending on those big guys up front for Kentucky. Because of their offensive line, Kentucky was tough to defend. Anytime you're that physical and consistent in one area of the game, you're going to have a chance to be pretty good. Really, it was just a shame that in spite of their offensive line and run game, they couldn't hit more explosive plays in their pass game, at least consistently, to maybe pull off an upset or two. And at the end of the day, that lack of balance in the pass game is what held them back in 2020. Do me a favor and subscribe and like. Thank you. And I'll see you on the next one.
Nicely done, nephew. Chase Thomas Podcast. Hell yeah.
Sugar Ray Leonard, Roberto Duran, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, and Thomas Hearns. Legends, whose four-way rivalry defined one of the greatest eras in boxing history. Relive their decade of dominance in the new Showtime sports documentary, The Kings, a four-part series premiering Sunday, June 6th, only on Showtime.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like, worry the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.